Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Miles Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Miller. Today, I welcome Brandon Johnson from Richmond, Virginia, who is an LCSW with experience of infertility. He has a website, Infertility Isn't Inferior. Actually, his agency is Infertility Isn't Inferior and has developed the Barren Battles Network. He's also spoken at many events like Resolve Midwest and some various other platforms and stuff regarding infertility awareness. So welcome, Brandon, to the episode.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, Stephen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. We've always enjoyed talking to you. And the first question I wanted to ask that I always ask every guest when they come on is, how did you first learn about infertility in general? And not necessarily your experience with infertility, but just in general, how did you learn about it?
I actually learned about infertility before I ever put a titled it infertility. And one way I learned is through a family member who just never had children. And my youth, I never put two and two together or never thought about it. Just figured he didn't want children. And so it was later on when they said he couldn't have kids and he always dated women with kids. Now I'm like, oh, okay. But still not really clicking at infertility. It came to me again in life when I had a coworker, and he was a little bit older than me. And just joking, I'm like, when are you going to have kids? When are you going to have kids? When are you going to have kids? And one day he answered, we're working on this, not from a lack of trying. You know, but I still didn't put two and two together. And then came my experience. Now I have a name for it. Now I have a title for it.
Right.
And so I reached back out to that coworker specifically and like, look, my apologies. I get it. Sorry for those years, and I'll never do it again. So that's when I actually put the name infertility to it, because other than that, I've never knew anyone who experienced it or was willing to talk about experiencing it. And so when I did come to actually understand what infertility was, it made me more sensitive about asking people wouldn't have children and their own thoughts.
Right.
So that's when I first learned of infertility. It was indirectly, but through my own journey, it was more personal.
Right. And that is kind of like what I've seen and heard from other men too. It's like you've either known somebody but never really put the name on it and stuff like that. But if you know some, a family member or something, or somebody like our family friend that's done, has gone through it, or it's like they've never heard about it their entire life, and then they get diagnosed and they're like, what, this is a thing? So, you know,
right.
Yeah. So I'm always curious about like how people learn about that. And that's kind of usually the two things. It's either that or that, you know. It's never like, oh, we discussed this in college, or we discussed this in sex ed, or, you know, anything like that. So you talk about how you kind of learned, you know, like through the years, like, but then you were finally able to have a word for it, you know, what you were experiencing with infertility. So like, what was your experience like with that? Like, what were the steps leading up to like that kind of diagnosis? And then like, what were the steps that you took afterward? Like, once you found out that you had the infertility?
The steps that led up to it were, well, let me make a long story short. In 2012, a year after we were married, my wife and I decided to try to have children. And we had just relocated. We felt stable enough to finally get started. And, you know, it just wasn't happening. And I was a little slow to get on board. I was actually quite ignorant at the time about the process. And it's because I come from a very fertile family, and I have a big family, so everyone just has babies. It's never been an issue. And so it took me like a year and a half to jump on board and to realize something was wrong. And I remember going to a urologist, and you know, he did the sperm sample, ultrasound, prostate check, and his answer was, I can't help you. I was like, okay. that's where we're just going to leave off. But he referred me to someone else. And that doctor did the same procedures. And then we did the, he just said, from what I can see, you're not producing. And gave me the diagnosis, unexplained infertility. Which threw me for another loop, because if it's infertility, why can't it be explained? You know, was I once good a long time ago? And now it's not producing anymore? What needs to change? What happened? And trying to figure out that diagnosis, it becomes difficult. In the meantime, while working to have children, I made a lot of lifestyle changes. So I lost weight, an extreme amount of weight, close to 200 pounds.
Okay.
I've changed the way I ate, you know, and you hear about all the supplements you take to help increase your chances. And the only thing I didn't do consistently was work out.
Okay.
And you're just in this funk now because, like, why me? And at that point, you begin this roller coaster.
So can I ask, though, like, when you were in that questioning of why, you know, like, why it's happening, especially when you have unexplained, you know, like, they give you, like, what happens, but they don't explain it, like, well, how did it happen or why? Did you ever catch yourself, like, going on, like Google and stuff and searching for those supplements, you know, like, or anything that you could have done, like, to maybe find answers?
I definitely looked at the supplements.
Okay.
All of them. All the ones that are supposed to boost fertility. Eating a fertility, boosting foods like walnuts and sweet potatoes and et cetera, pomegranate. The herbs ashwagandha, maca.
Yeah, for pomegranates and stuff are supposed to be good too. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
No change in results.
Yeah. I know, like, from my experience, that was one thing I was always, you know, and even now, I mean, it's very rare now that I do know, because it's been a number of years now, but you find you're still asking why, you know, like, why did this happen, you know? And I know, like, I've referenced this book quite a bit, but Renee Almeling had written a book called Gynecology, The Missing Science of Men's Reproductive Health. And it's crazy. I would recommend reading it. It was definitely insightful for me to see, like, if you looked at the history of, you know, how women have a specialty of reproductive health and stuff, OBGYNs, and men have really nothing. You know, like, I mean, like, there's a little, I think, andrology, but it's very little has made progress with, you know, when you looked at the research compared to for reproductive health for women compared to men, like, the research has been very limited compared to women. And I think that just speaks to, right. But I think it goes into that narrative, right, that historically we've all been told infertility is a women's issue. And I think science kind of, like, played along with that narrative that it's a women's issue, and they felt like, I didn't live back then, you know, but my speculation would be is that that was their belief, probably, you know, like, that this was a woman, and they didn't even think about looking at male factor.
I think it still is, because when I first went to my primary care doctor, he at first asked me, did my wife go, did she get tested? And that was his first question. So it's still plays the part that infertility is a woman's issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I had the different, experience where I think when we went through her OBGYN to, like, to get those talks started. But I think at that point, we both were tested, I want to say, at the same time and stuff. And I know that that's not always, you know, common stuff, but at least the one that we had, like, we were both tested at the same time. So
I congratulate you for being on board.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but I remember, I share in my first episode too, that it was hard, you know, for me, because, like, I remember thinking, I just pray that's not me, because I knew the guilt, you know, like that I would feel like if it was me, you know, that I was getting in the way of her, you know, like, so the kind of offshoot off that question then is like, did you have any of those experiences? Like when you were first kind of diagnosed, like what were some of those thoughts and feelings that you had?
After I was first diagnosed, I was pushed to the side. It was like, okay, we can no longer focus on you. Let's work on getting a child. And so I kind of feel like as men, when we receive our diagnosis, if it's not something that can be surgically repaired, then we're often put out the equation of trying to build your family. Yeah. And so we went to the reproductive endocrinology. You know, it was all about my wife. And I'm like, I'm in this room too. You have to pay attention to me as well. Doctors have this way of kind of talking past you. And I'm not sure if this is a male thing or what. But there's definitely this way of talking past you, talk to the woman. And really, it just became focused on her. And it almost makes you feel uninvolved in the process. And I remember that just being painful. I'm like, I'm a part of this too, yet.
Right.
You know, I feel like I'm being ignored.
Yeah.
And trying to find out why I'm being ignored is probably the most difficult part of it. I'm like, am I being ignored because I'm a man? Am I being ignored because technically there's nothing I can do? Or nothing they can do for me. And then dreadfully, I go, it's like, are you ignoring me because I'm black? You know, which of the three is it?
Yeah.
You know, and no matter which three it is, it's just upsetting.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times, like, men aren't even included, you know, like in the conversation, you know, about how is it impacting them emotionally? I mean, yes, it may be their decision-making and stuff, but like, yeah, you've had, you know, like people do have those experiences where men are often the silent partner, right? I mean, that's a quote from Bill Peacock, who's done a lot of great work in this field, but it's true though. I mean, like it's, you know, we're not often engaged, you know, like with other doctors and stuff, you know, like, what are our thoughts, you know, like, and it is a couple's issue, you know, like it's not a woman's issue, a male issue, it's a couple's issue, you know, like, and you're just as much part of that equation. So this is going to be like a kind of an ad lib question then, but I've always been curious too, like, so with that, like, do you have any thoughts on how that interaction could be improved, you know, like with doctors and having doctors hit with the interaction with like the male patient of the couple?
For men, I want men to just be more assertive. You know, invite yourself into those conversations and into those spaces and ask questions. And if you have to, go over questions before the doctor's appointment and tell your wife you're going to specifically ask these questions so that you can be involved in the process. For doctors, if a couple is coming in there, pay attention to both people. They both have concerns. They both have the same fear. They both have the same worry. Don't focus on the woman. Don't focus on the woman only when the husband is right there with questions of how to comfort his wife. You know, and the first doctor was, he was pretty good. He was pretty honest. I'll give him that first reproductive endocrinologist. It's the, when he retired and the second one we have, he just ignored me completely. But the first one was like, explained the process to both of us, explained the chances. So he was more involved in making sure we both understood. The second to like interrupt.
Yeah, and that's huge. Men aren't well educated in the like women's reproductive, you know, system and stuff. I mean, like we know some, but like we're not as knowledgeable as they are, you know, like, and we're left with like, well, like, what does this mean? What does this hormone do? Like, where does this hormone need to be at? And, you know, what does this medication do? You know, like, we're very much, you know, wanting to know, like, what our, like, our wives are going to go through, you know, and the reason why we're doing this, you know, like, and like you said, the odds, you know, like the odds of it. And I can remember one appointment of ours where the doctor said, you know, like, oh, we're going to give you a 15% chance, you know, like of being successful. And I was like, and my wife was devastated and looked at her. I'm like, that's not good enough. You know, like we'll find somewhere else, you know, like, and we did, we found somewhere else to go. But I think that's where, like you said, you step up and you ask those questions and stuff and you be the support and stuff. Cause you deserve just as much knowledge as your wife or significant other.
Yeah. And if one person panics, someone has to be there. Someone has to be supportive. Because they throw out scary figures. And I don't know if these are their own statistics that they just put together or if they're just the statistics based on common practice. But they pull them out so quick. And you're like, where'd that come from, Doc?
Right.
Our statistic, things like I'm going to never have a child.
Right. So once you had that diagnosis, like what were like the steps like that you took afterwards? Like what did you do with that information? Like did you guys do IVF adoption? What were your next steps?
I cried.
Okay. Yeah.
Literally. I would love to say that was a joke, but I cried in the middle of a restaurant. I remember the day vividly. I took a half day off work to go to the doctor's appointment. And he had just told her. And so I was going to go back to work and the wife's like, let's get lunch first. And I'm like, let me get to work. He's like, no, let's get lunch first. And so we're sitting in the middle of this pub restaurant and I'm eating and then I just start crying. I'm like, I can't believe it. You know, I always wanted a family and this doctor is telling me that I can't have a family naturally. And we have went through options before. We have talked about donor. We have talked about adoption. We have talked about the various ways. And at that point, it was just the reality that I would have to choose one of these ways. And I was flat out angry. Because you see people have families haphazardly.
Right.
And here I was, I did it purposeful and intentful and you know, struggle through this thing called college then to build a family.
Yeah.
You know, all of just like, I got here and no, to be denied. And so I wasn't quite ready for a while. I think I went into a state of depression where I just kind of wanted to give up everything. You know, the only thing I didn't give up or attempt to give up was work. And that's because I wanted to live because it's just cold.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to deal with negative 40 degree weather in the car or trying to live out of a car.
Right.
So eventually I got to the point where I can look at donors and choose a donor and finally get past my own ego to realize what's most important. Is it being a father or is it making sure the child comes from my own genetics? And at the end of the day, I chose being a father over worrying about my own genetics because I just want the experience and the love to pass down to this little being who will eventually become an adult who I hope to pass, he passed down and hopefully, well, it's a he now because it's in hindsight, but
Yeah. Hopefully
have another child that they can also be loving individuals and I can also pass down love and build our family through them.
Yeah, and it's just such a powerful thing to say it too, because I mean the fatherhood doesn't mean blood related either, you know, like, and I think, you know, people that don't struggle with it, and I might speak for everyone, but you know, some people have said things like, oh, if you're, you know, that's not your true dad, you know, like, no, like you're the one raising it, like that's what makes a father, you know, like not the blood that is shared, you know. And I know I've had another guest earlier this summer, that kind of talked about his same thing about like trying to figure out like using donor, and it's a soul searching topic to be thinking about. You know, I think none of us, you know, like have ever thought, you know, to be in that field, you know, be in that experience and stuff, you know, and having to make that decision is one that takes a little bit of mindfulness and thorough soul searching.
Yes. And I never found myself being more picky. I was like, 5'7", you're short. Sorry.
Yeah.
And just kind of going through the process. Eventually, we chose adoption, but we tried IUI 5 or 6 times prior to going towards adoption.
Okay.
And those obviously were failed attempts, which I think that part drove me more to incorporate infertility into my practice than my own experience almost.
Okay.
While they both are hand in hand, no one prepares you for the pain of a failed IUI or IVF. And there's so much investment in going into it. The medications and procedures, the pills, and there's so much dedication. And for women, it's invasive. And when you don't get the result you're looking for, it's just like a shot in the back or something. It stings.
Yeah, it's devastating.
Definitely. And no one prepares you how to deal with those emotions. And the first time, you're like, okay, well, maybe it didn't. But once you get past the first two, the rest are just like, someone has a personal vendetta against me. Like, why is it not working? And the after effects of finding out you're infertile are never easy. Even adoption isn't easy. We were fortunate. I think timing of when we got everything and how we got our son was very fortunate. But I have met couples who've been on a wait list for years.
Right.
You know, and I'm just like, I'm sorry. And I know the pain. But to have to go through that process and constantly be on high alert and always ready for years is its own emotional toll.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think waiting is like the hardest part, you know, because you have parents that want to adopt and just waiting for that, you know, that call to say like, hey, we found, you know, like, and these parents, I mean, there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through the adoption process too. You know, you have the home study, you know, that's really, really intrusive. You know, I get it. I get the reason why, you know, because of history and stuff, you know, like, but it really is, you know, like intrusive, especially when you're the one wanting one, you know, like, and it's a hard thing to kind of like justify, because I know I had a coworker whose friends were doing the same thing and she was filling out a reference form for them and stuff. And it's just like I said, on a professional level, I get it. You know, like I get the reason why, but like, if you think about it from an infertility lens, I mean, I always joke with my wife. It's like, we're professional hoop jumpers, you know, like, but that's what we are.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, either process is not easy.
And even adoption, you still have to be chosen.
Right.
Just to recall the beginning stages of my son, we were in competition with other families, with other potential parents.
Yeah.
And I was like, we won. Is essentially the feeling you get afterwards. But
yeah,
to think about that, the people who weren't chosen, now they have to go through it again.
Yeah. So. Well, I know, and there's statistics out there too. And then to highlight adoption and even foster care, because I mean, that's always something that people mention, right? It's like, well, just do foster care. Yeah, like, which is great. I mean, it's not a bad option. It's great for some people, but not all. But I remember reading that, I want to say that adoptive parents were 10 times as likely to go through fertility treatments than those that didn't. And foster parents, like 39% of foster parents said that their motivation to become a foster parent was because of infertility. I always think about that deeper level thinking, you know, like when you have like some of these foster care workers, you know, like, or CPS or child welfare workers and stuff, you know, they're working with foster parents, you know, like looking at that deeper level of like, what is their experience? What got them there? Like, what was the reason why, you know? And not that that's saying like that's going to be a qualifier for their parenting, but like, it is another level to think about, you know.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of shift gears. So I do, like, this is something that it's really, I'm very passionate about, is like, is understanding from the cultural lens, as well as like equal access, you know, like equity. And I know it's your experience as a therapist, and I know that this doesn't speak for everyone, you know, but like, what is the consensus about infertility, like within the Black community, you know, in the sense of, I don't know, like, I know there's variety, you know, of ways that people think about it, but like in your experience as a therapist working with people, what's been the general consensus?
It's a lack of access, and it's also unspoken. And in some ways, they can both coincide with each other. There's a Regina. Regina's her name. She's on Instagram. The Broken Brown Egg.
Yep.
She posted a map of Chicago and showed where all the infertility clinics were. They were all north of the city or downtown Chicago, basically in predominantly white areas. So to get access, when you're not from that area, you have to work harder.
Yeah.
You have to be intentional, and you have to want to get fixed. With the stigma of medical care in a Black community, there's almost this nature of, I don't want to say giving up, but it's a passive nature when it comes to medical. Because with so many negative medical experiences, it's just a lack of trust.
Yeah.
If you have to go, in this case, I'm using Chicago mainly because it's where I'm originally from, so I know the landscape. But if you have to go miles and travel an hour just to get to the north side of the city, is it worth it, or is it worth the investment? How bad do you want it, or can you find another way to build your family, or do you just live childless and be okay with it? But there are so many barriers now that I think are starting to be broken on a very minute level, where people are starting to talk about their experiences more and talk about infertility and how they're affected, and how treatment isn't easily accessible. And if it, and when you do find treatment, can you even afford it?
Right.
Because it's expensive for anyone, unless you're just a millionaire.
Right.
Literally.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've read, I mean, the statistics, and that is actually in the book Reproductive Ethics, which I don't think I have on me right now, but it's Reproductive Ethics in Clinical Practice or something like that. It was a really excellent book. And I forget the name of the person, because there are more of like essays in the books, you know. And in that book is kind of where I learned that, so like Black women or people or women of color are 1.5 to 2 times more likely to experience infertility than white women, but yet they have the least amount of access. Because I think there's this idea, this, you know, from white majority that, and this is kind of perpetuated by media as well, as like the Black community is like almost like super fertile, which is not the case, you know, like it's completely false and stuff. And I think they base policies off of this as well, you know. And I don't know, like there's gotta be ways to increase access. And it's actually and you kind of touched on this a little bit just now, but like, how does culture play a part in decision making about options faced with an infertility diagnosis?
You asked me a question, I had a conflicting thought. Not a conflicting thought, but an agreeing thought. And it comes to media. For some reason, when we focus on Black culture or even just minority culture at all, it always goes down to the negative aspects of it. You know, so you see the woman who has many children and there's no father figure around. It's constantly shown. And you see the negative aspects of it. What we don't see is the families who are trying, the families who are building, the families who are actually going through these pains. So this negative image continues to be spread throughout the media and create this narrative that we're all fertile.
Right.
And just pop out babies, and that's what we do as a hobby. So it's when you break down cultures, we all live in the same, I keep wanting to say diaphragm, but that is not the right word.
Diorama? Maybe?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And no matter the culture, you see the constant, you see the same things over and over. And yet it's ignored when it comes to minorities, because it's almost as if, you know, those feelings, those thoughts don't exist. With access, I would love for access to be more readily available, or, and better than access, the education of it. I don't think in the general public, we're not educated on infertility at all.
No. Nope.
And that's just everyone. I think it's more so when you look at minority groups and you begin to just focus on specific issues, hypertension, diabetes, cancer, and you tend to wrap those three things around it. And I speak to people like, I never thought about infertility, or I never came across this. Now, how do I fix it? How do I get access to it? And it becomes less available or discouraging when you try to go to some place that you travel for and now you're not treated well, or you look down upon, or it's like, why are you here? And do you fit in? I compare this experience to moving to Minnesota. And I love Minnesota, don't get me wrong, but there are just many times you walk into a restaurant and I'm like, hey, we're the only ones here today. You know, and it's that experience. It's like, how are you going to be treated? How are the people going to care for you? And if that experience is negative, then you give up, because you assume this is how everyone is going to look at you. So I don't know if this, I do believe it needs to be in closer access versus having to travel so far away. But I wonder if, I don't want to say cultural competency more than human sensitivity is needed as it relates to infertility.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it needs to be more like cultural humility, you know, like of just coming to that point of like, how does like people think of things differently? It's just, we're, I don't think anybody can be completely competent, like besides in their own culture, you know, like of other people's right. culture, you know, like it's just coming to the table to like kind of be curious, you know, like, okay, what is this? What is it? This diagnosis like for you? Like, what are your thoughts? What are your, you know, feelings behind it? You know, and even within culture, there's variability, you know, like if everybody yeah. thinks about it differently, you know, some people who are, you know, like are very tied to religion, you know, they may see that as, oh, playing God's work, I'm not going to do that. And that's okay. That's their choice. You know, like that's their belief, you know, but I think, yeah, coming to that lens, because like even within that article about the statistics with Black women and women of color, she started off the entire essay just like said, me saying like, close your eyes and imagine you walk into a fertility clinic. What does your fertility patient look like? And I think the majority of people would see like a middle or upper class white woman like sitting there in the fertility clinic, you know, and it created in this doctor herself, like it, you know, she had that experience where like she looked at the name and stuff and she just very briefly looked at the chart, walked in, and it was a Black woman, and it threw her off. And she's like, what this, you know, like, and she spoke to that experience and she's like, this is not right. You know, like, it's like, this is like, you know, a young woman that deserves, you know, the care that she's come for, you know, and stuff. But, you know, but that also plays into media and representation, right? I mean, like, when you look at all the fertility documentaries and stuff, and I'm sure there's some out there, but like the majority of them are coming up from white couples and stuff about fertility and fertility doctors and stuff like that. And I just think that we need just more diversity and stuff in, not even just in academic medicine, but even with dealing with the emotional toll, you know, like of infertility and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's such an array of experiences and how culture plays into that and religion. I mean, there's so many factors, and looking at it one way is not going to help everyone.
No, far from it. And when you look at it from a cultural lens, religion, what you mentioned is huge. You know, I'm Christian, and so there's this, you know, concept of like, we'll pray, we'll pray, we'll pray. And I'm like, you think I haven't been talking to God? I'm on my knees every night. It's just not happening. And so even then, you have to take a step back and understand that it's okay to hold on to your beliefs and have your concepts of God and religion. But also, how does that impact you into choosing your destination from your family? And the Bible mentioned many examples of infertility taking place. So even then, it wasn't, you know, we'll have a child. Still focused on a woman, but not even then it was focused on a child. But if someone's cultural lens, or if someone's lens is more through religion than their culture, then you also have to be able to coach them to that and give them the examples and the walkthrough. You know, Abraham, his first son is through a mistress, not his wife. Was like, and that's because he wanted a child, you know, but later they were blessed with a child, you know. Granted, it came naturally at older age, but there's many cases of adoption within the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everything except for IUI and IVF.
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't around back then. So, no. Yeah, but I remember being at the ASRM conference in Baltimore last year, and there was a talk about, it was more of a historical lens. It was the mother and the daughter. The daughter was the fourth born baby by IVF, and then the doctor that helped them. And I want to say the doctor was from Argentina. I was somewhere in South America. And there was a lot of talk about like how, especially back then and still to this day, you hear it, you know, about, you know, reproductive endocrinologists, you know, people will say from a religious lens, like, well, they're playing God, you know. And the one thing that that doctor said was, this is like, I'm not playing God, I'm just facilitating a meeting, you know. And it was basically because realistically, like IVF, IUI, all those procedures, like, it's not 100% guaranteed that that's going to result in a child. You know, so it's really about looking at it from the lens of, like, at least in my opinion, you know, like it's facilitating a meeting, you know, like you're, you know, God put people in your life, you know, to kind of help with whatever you have, you know.
That's not a bad way to look at it.
Yeah.
Because I never took the, well, personally, I never thought about it as playing God. You know, I just thought of an alternative way to build your family, and that your family would just not be traditional in a sense.
Yeah. So one of the last questions, well, I mean, actually, there's a couple questions I want to ask you. I know we've talked about it briefly and stuff, but what are your thoughts on increasing access to fertility treatments or other means of family building, you know, like within like the, you know, Black community or minority?
I thought about this question, and I don't know where it begins, because it's a twofold problem. One problem is education in general. And when I say the education part, I mean, we talk about the teacher shortage, but we don't talk about the medical doctor shortage. And there is a medical doctor shortage. And are they going into general practice, or what's their specialty? Is it, how many of them are going into reproductive sciences? And to increase access, you also have to increase the amount of doctors headed towards that way, which means you also have to increase awareness. You know, there are more oncologists these days because cancer has such a great awareness. And when it comes to reproductive science, doctors and even your general doctors shy away from it, shy away from the conversation. So one, create access. You have to create the need and show the awareness of it. And after that, I think that every clinic, or not, maybe not every clinic, that might be a little overzealous, but I think there should be education from urologists and OBGYN about infertility as your patient goes through it. As you see that woman who goes through early menopause and you know, might want egg preservation so that they can carry later. But I don't think these conversations come up very much. I haven't heard them coming up very much. And up until people have their own journey, infertility is just still this taboo existence on this other side of the plane of the earth where no one talks about it, but you experience some suffering silence.
Yeah.
So I think access comes with education. It took a long time to get the educational part of it, because even the doctors didn't give the education behind infertility. They just gave you the diagnosis, and I had to live with the diagnosis before I was able to actually research it.
That is my huge effort right now, and more within social work, counseling, and like psychology, but even within our classes, our graduate level classes, this isn't talked about. It rarely is talked about. I won't say it's not, but it's rarely, you know, talked about. And people that are in graduate school or even undergrad, you know, that are like juniors and seniors, you know, like, yes, they're not thinking about building their family at this point, but they're also coming very naive regarding the reality of infertility. They don't know that infertility is a thing. Most of them. Some of them probably have had experience, but the majority probably don't realize infertility is a thing. And that in itself, then it creates like this whole thing of like, then what do we do with this? You know, like I've seen friendships, you know, like get broken up because like they can't understand. Like, well, we've been told our whole life, we got pregnant, why can't you? You know, like, you know, and the platitudes, right? Like, well, you should just adopt. You should just, you know, it's a lack of education and awareness, you know. And I strongly feel like if we can at least provide that awareness and education, at least at the graduate level, you know, like not only will the likelihood that they will know somebody that experience or go through that experience, they themselves might go through that experience. And not that it's going to take the emotional pain away, but it gives them that awareness or education. Like, what are my options? What might my friend be going through? So it's creating that support, but also it might even increase the person's likelihood to maybe want to be in this field. You know, like if working in like reproductive mental health or in med school, right? It may intrigue them. Like, I never, you know, like even knew about this. And I think it's a creative way. I mean, I don't like there's more to it than that, but really those are the next cohort of people building families. So let's create awareness, you know, for them before they have to experience it.
And it doesn't take the pain away, but it gives you some awareness. It at least gives you the knowledge.
Right.
And so when we could go down to access, I look at it from an economic model, which is supply and demand.
Yeah.
You know, the demand is there, the supply is low. As soon as people make more noise about it and it becomes so common, it comes common and not taboo, I think access will definitely increase.
Yeah. So I've got one last question for you. May I ask every guest this? What is something that you would want every man to know that is going through infertility?
You are not alone. And it's why. It is literally why I do what I do. It is why you're going to do what you're going to do. It's why you have the podcast. It's why we have both talked to people both nationally and internationally. It's because we are obviously not alone. And when you're going through this journey, I felt alone. And I had no one to talk to. I looked for a therapist myself. And I was like, there's no male therapist. I need somebody who's been through this because this is painful and I'm losing myself. And there was none. And I'm like, okay, Brandon, you're a therapist. Let's add this in.
Yeah.
Brandon, be a responsible therapist. Don't go in it on emotional, but learn and educate yourself more about the process of infertility and how it affects you. And does it just boil down to infertility? But now we have miscarriages. We have stillborns. We have a topic
pregnancy. Yeah.
And we have all these other methods in which people lose their ability to have children, or it becomes a risk to their own lives, which essentially deems them as infertile. And going through that process, because it's just as painful, and learning how to cope with emotions, and man, we are not alone. We're just not alone. And we can't always be strong for our partners and expect ourselves to be okay, because we're not okay. We have feelings and we need to express them. We need to talk about them. We need to admit when we don't know what we're doing for our spouse. You know, we have to admit that we're broken because we also lost.
Right.
We lost the child. We lost the, we failed together. One of the things I say to every couple is that you have to prepare for success and failure at the same time. I don't think I'm wrong in that case, because you just never know the outcome.
Right. And it just seems like we're alone in it because we're not talking about it.
Right.
I think it's a huge piece, you know.
There's no media on infertility, or it's very limited media on infertility.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, there's some podcasts, but there's one in Australia. There's, you know, maybe a couple in UK, but when it comes to the United States, I mean, this is pretty much it. You know, like, you might have some fertility podcasts with a sprinkling of male infertility, yeah. But. And you're right. I guess this is one of the biggest reasons why, you know, I wanted to share that men are not alone in this. And there's other stories out there, you know, like, and everybody's story is different. You know, everybody has different routes, but we're all kind of achieving the same goal here, is to build your family. And it's really just getting people to talk about it.
Yes. And I think the more we talk about it, the greater awareness will bring to it, and also hopefully increase access.
Yeah.
Where we'll say, hey, we're all suffering together.
Yeah.
We need the access, and it's not closed off to this group of people who live in this area, who happens to have looked this way, or I have such a huge vision of where infertility can grow into, to bring awareness, because our stats are declining.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going over your time, Stephen, so I don't want to ramble on too long, but right now the U.S. is 1 in 8, U.K. is 1 in 7. I have to reread an article, but New Zealand was something ridiculously low. And I keep wanting to reread this article because I think it's at 1 in 2, and I just can't get past the fact that half the population can't get pregnant. I'm not there yet mentally.
Yeah.
But that's what I read. I read it like 5 times. I put it down because I just couldn't get over it. And I'm like, I'm going to come back to it. And I haven't came back to it yet.
Yeah. I think Canada's 1 in 6. I think it's from my understanding.
Yeah. So
yeah.
We're on the wrong side of this number, of this ratio. We're on the wrong side. and we're not increasing. There's nothing increasing. So we're going to have to talk about it because more and more people will experience it.
I think we're missing a lot of people too in that statistic. Because there's a lot of people that aren't going to access fertility treatments, that aren't going to have a diagnosis of infertility. You know, there's people that are just like, well, it hasn't happened. We'll just adopt. You know, I mean, I think there's people that are missing in that statistic, you know, like, and you can't encompass for 100% of everybody, but I feel like there could be a little bit better way of kind of figuring that piece out. Because I know as therapist, you know, like those that are not specialized in general practice, you know, like doing intakes, it's not talked about, you know, like from other therapists I've asked, it's like, have you talked about infertility? If you brought up infertility, like, or miscarriage, like in your intake, you know, and the majority of them, no, I didn't even think about asking them. I'm like, it's just as traumatic as receiving a cancer diagnosis. Why wouldn't we ask that? You know, like, and I've had some people say, like, well, we can't ask them everything, you know, like, and we have to wait to bring it up. I said the likelihood that they're probably going to bring it up is probably small because there's so much stigma to it. They don't want to share it, you know, so it's like we have an opportunity to reduce stigma here by bringing it up and saying, like, hey, it is safe to talk about this.
Yes. And speaking to that point, I have had couples who have come to me for couples therapy. And in the midst of them going back and forth during a session, when I allow them to, all of a sudden infertility comes up. And now it's a concern.
Yeah.
You know, so it will be huge to ask up front or talk about any traumas related.
Right.
And the one thing I want to add on to what you said about not always being, or not everyone not being included, I think of the endometriosis community or the PCOS community, in which sometimes there's a hysterectomy involved to cure the, I shouldn't say cure, to try to limit the pain and symptoms of endometriosis or PCOS, which automatically puts them into the infertile community. But it's never thought of that way or even accounted for, even though that's exactly what's just been done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we've come up on our time. And Brandon, I really appreciate you coming on and spending some time today to talk about this really important topic and sharing your experience with us. It's definitely something I think everybody can learn about, especially with racial equity and access to treatment. Just your story in general as well, you know. So I will put links to his website and social media as well, like in the show notes, so you can follow him on the platform that he uses. And yeah, thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Stephen. It's been great as always.
Yep. Sounds good. Thank you for listening to the Miles Podcast. Miles Podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. I also just started a Facebook page this last week for the podcast, so you can search for it on there. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com. And I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.